Okay, we're going to get started. Today is April 12th, 2019. It is 12 p.m. and this panel is 4303, entitled, Is Social Media the New Frontier for Women's Rights? My name is Jamie Skirsky. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Communication here, where I study gender and identity and media. And during this session, you may submit questions via the CWA app. If you are a student or remote, please indicate that in your question. There will also be producers walking around if you want to submit via note card. So it's my pleasure to introduce, we were supposed to have three speakers today. I don't know if we're going to be down to two. Oh, she's on her way. Okay, so.
You should wait for her.
Should we wait or should we get started? No, keep going. Okay.
No, it's noon.
So let me first introduce Lux Alptrom, who writes about sex, feminism, and popular culture. Her debut book came out last year entitled Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truth They Reveal. And it sheds light on the cultural narratives that produce sexual shame for women and how we can own our own sexuality. BuzzFeed says this book will change your life.
Also, it's available for sale at Mackey and wherever else books are sold.
And next to Lux is Barrett Anderson, who brings expertise on the relationship between democracy and technology and speaks about the challenges and threats emerging on the internet. She is the CEO and editor-in-chief at Scout.ai, a media company exploring the future of technology through science fiction and scenario-playing games. Her work on information warfare basically makes me feel like we're all living in a Black Mirror episode. So thank you all for being here. I will introduce our last speaker when she comes in, and I'm going to invite both of our speakers to open with some remarks, and then I'll follow up with some questions, and we'll get engaged with the audience.
So, yeah, we're talking about women and social media, which is a very appropriate panel for me, as I am an extremely online girl. I have been on Twitter since 2007, like a few months after it started, and it is very much a part of my daily life. So I am really passionate about this topic, and I think it's a really important one to discuss. So in the description of this panel, one of the questions that's asked is about how social media impacts women's activism and organizing, and whether the benefits outweigh the costs. And I think when a lot of us think about women and online activism, and especially Twitter, one of the main things that comes to mind is Me Too. And Me Too, as we all know, you know, viral social media campaign where women were opening up about their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual abuse and sexual assault that got a lot of attention in 2017. And also felt like the culmination of a cultural moment in which abusers and harassers who had long acted badly without any kind of social repercussion were finally being outed, finally being held to account, and in some cases, you know, forced to really make amends and forced to really deal with the harm that they had done. I think Me Too is a really interesting entry point for this discussion because, number one, we can all say that, yeah, Me Too did a lot, but at the same time, Me Too was one of many campaigns that have happened over the years. Just to give you a sense of prior to Me Too, in 2014 we had hashtag Yes All Women. There was also hashtag Not Okay. There was also hashtag Why Women Don't Report. And some of these had, you know, different variations on what they were focused on, but they were all women using social media to publicly draw attention to sexual assault and the experiences of being a woman in the patriarchy. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about this whole genre of social media activism. I think in the case of Me Too, it was really powerful and it really started to energize people and get results. But at the same time, a lot of these social media movements are women being asked to expose our pain, being asked to share to package our most traumatic and most upsetting moments for public consumption, and in some cases, fundamentally public entertainment. And oftentimes nothing gets done. And so when I think about the positives here, I think that as a consciousness-raising tool, as a way of allowing women and sexual and victims of sexual violence to connect with one another, to feel less alone, to educate one another about our experiences, it's incredibly powerful. But do I think it's going to change the world on its own? Not so much. I mean, Me Too kickstarted a moment because Me Too came after Harvey Weinstein had been outed as a predator in the New York Times. There was already something happening offline through a major institution that then Me Too paired with, and because it was like, oh, now it's trending, now it's a thing that's in the air, that inspired more people to out more men and help build a movement. But I think the social media aspect on its own was not going to lead to Louis C.K. getting taken down, was not going to lead to any of these famous men being outed finally as predators. And so, you know, I think when we talk about social media for activism purposes, we need to primarily think of it as an education tool, as a way of raising visibility for causes, as a way of connecting people, which is all super important and super powerful. But we also have to understand that the actual cultural change that we seek is going to happen offline. It's going to happen in our government. It's going to happen through our media really raising awareness and putting pressure on people to change things. It's going to happen in concert with social media and other more traditional forms of activism.
Thank you. Barrett, do you want to open? And then Daisy, I'll introduce you after Barrett's comments.
Thanks, Lex. That was awesome. So I want to tell a couple of stories from my life that I think illustrate. Can you guys hear me? Now, can you hear me? I'll just go like this. It feels very natural to speak to you all in this way. So I want to tell a couple of stories from my life that I think illustrate both the power and the potential and the problem of women's movements online. I'm going to to start with, I started my company online, right, using social media. We used a Kickstarter campaign to kick off our company. And we were able to connect with some really incredible people, including some really, for me personally, some really incredible female mentors that I would never have met, ever, if it weren't for the power of Twitter, basically. And that has like been a huge asset for me. I've met many of those people in real life. You know, they've become my real friends. And I think it's a very powerful thing to be able to connect with people who are going through the same kinds of things and struggling with the same kinds of challenges that you are. Because the most fundamental thing I think that we face as women is that we don't necessarily, for so long, we have not been supposed to talk about the problems that we have, right? We're not supposed to talk about the fact that we have miscarriages or we have abortions. We're not supposed to talk about the fact that we've been sexually assaulted. We're not supposed to talk about the fact that, you know, we might be running a company, but we're also having some really shitty days, and it's really hard. And by the way, entrepreneurs have a very high rate of suicide and depression. Those are all things that we are not supposed to talk about, right? They're not traditionally publicly acceptable things. And especially in the entrepreneurialism community, you cannot be a public persona and identify personally with any of those things, right? Like it's not that you can't, but it's traditionally been frowned upon. And I think one of the most powerful things that, in particular, Twitter gives us is the ability, but also Facebook to some extent, you know, is the ability to connect with people who share those experiences and to learn from their life experiences. Because as women, you know, we are not going through these things for the first time by ourselves, right? There are a lot of other women out there who've been through the same kinds of experiences that you have. And maybe it's not exactly the same thing, but they did it, and they screwed some things up, and there are some things that they would like to do have done differently. And so that, I think, is the most amazing thing about social media, is the ability to connect with people and find people without necessarily having to, you know, you can do it privately if you want, you don't have to be public about it, but it's a really incredible asset from that perspective. I would not want to have started my company or to be an entrepreneur or to be a woman in the world without social media. On the other side of things, I think Lux made a really good point about, you know, this kind of like performative pain, right? So the Me Too movement, you know, when the Me Too movement happened, I had a really complex reaction to it, because I had just gone through a really painful experience within my friend group where I realized that someone had sexually assaulted multiple of my friends. And it was this very traumatic experience of trying to figure out, what do you do when this happens, right? What do you do when there is a man in your friend group who you learn has sexually assaulted like 5 or 6 of your female friends? And none of them actually knew it, right? They didn't even actually think that it was sexual assault at the time, because they thought it was just kind of like, well, I mean, I guess I should have just been more vocal, or I guess I should have just been more whatever, you know? I feel like I did something wrong, or maybe I let him on, or maybe I hooked up with him once, and then the second time I said no, but like maybe because the first time I said okay, like I didn't say anything, you know. So there are all of these stories that we tell ourselves about why it's not okay to talk about these things, or why it's our fault. And so when the Me Too movement happened, you know, I had just gone through this experience. A lot of the women involved, several of them at least, had filed charges. And we'd gone through this whole process where we had gone through the process of filing charges. You know, I was not personally affected by that, but I was kind of trying to be there and support a lot of my friends who were. And I, you know, put out my own, made my own police statement. I was, remember, calling from the bathroom at work. I had to file my police statement over the phone in the bathroom at work. And it was a terrible experience. It was a horrible experience. But when the Me Too movement happened, I didn't really want to participate. You know, I didn't really feel like my experience with that fit into, and that wasn't my only experience with it, but I didn't feel like that experience fit into the box of Me Too, right? And I didn't actually feel like sharing it. Like, for a very long time, it was really something that I just, like, didn't really talk about, right? And it actually really ruined our, like, many friendships for a while. Like, they're starting to heal now, but there were a lot of really painful things that came out of that. So I'll wrap up there, but I think the underlying question about women and activism and Me Too is really like, what vulnerabilities are we permitting women to tell online, and what boxes, you know, it's okay to talk about sexual assault, but only if it fits in a tweet. Or it's okay to talk about sexual assault, or, you know, it's okay to talk about gender bias, but only if you, you know, you're a powerful woman who doesn't wear makeup. But if you want to be a girly woman who also is in business, that's not okay, right? So there are all of these kind of conflicting ideas I think we have about women. I tweeted something recently where, you know, I was like, hey, here's this interesting thing. Here's this famous writer who, like, struggled with self-doubt constantly, right? And, like, I identify with that. And someone else on Twitter reached out to me and said, hey, if you identify with that, how can anyone else, like, say that they, like, if you're feeling like, you know, you have self-doubt, how can any of us, else of us have a chance? And I was like, you know, that's kind of the point. We all have self-doubt. Just because you've started a business, or just because, you know, you've written something and you're famous, does not mean that you're not struggling with all of those same things. And I think the more that we can open up possibility for the women around us and not put those preconstrained boundaries around who we think they should be, the better off we'll all be.
Thank you, Barrett. And Daisy, we're glad you could join us. Let me do a brief introduction. Daisy Kahn is listed among Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, and Glamour Magazine named her 7 Women You Must Follow on Twitter. So just FYI, I'm following you all now on Twitter. She has been at the forefront of combating anti-Muslim bias for 2 decades and is the founder of the largest global network of Muslim women committed to peace building, gender equality, and human dignity. Her memoir, Born with Wings, comes out on April 24th.
Thank you very much. And, you know, we've all heard the good, the bad, and the ugly of social media. I personally use social media, and I've connected with friends that I knew in high school, and it's a great platform for that kind of stuff. But we also know that there is a really ugly side to social media. So I'm not going to be very optimistic today, and I'm just giving you a warning, because I will be speaking about specifically how this platform can destroy lives and has destroyed lives. And if not corrected, and if we don't have new policies and we don't have changes, we can see more lives getting destroyed. And So I will focus my comments on ISIS specifically because we've done a lot of research, as was mentioned, on this issue. We heard that there were all these people from all over the world that were joining ISIS, and including women. But did we ever understand why this movement was so successful? And one reason why women were joining ISIS was there was rampant Islamophobia. They were feeling alienation. They were feeling persecuted. They felt discriminated. And especially those women who were wearing hijab and who were visibly Muslim were perceived as belonging to an oppressive, misogynist religion, and women who lack autonomy to make decisions on their own. And this was all the multiple feelings that were going on in their heads. These discontents made these women very vulnerable targets for female recruiters who lured them with a promise of sisterhood and a vision of change. You can be a mother of a new nation. This is a tall order for somebody who's so conflicted in their head. And yes, you heard me correctly, women recruiters. Women recruiters serving as groomers, propagandists in the domain of social media. They felt a sense of empowerment that somehow they were actively contributing to the battle on the ground, just by the click of their fingers. These women played a crucial role in attracting Western women to ISIS through their online presence, where they were able to propagate a romanticized notion of the life of the caliphate, of what it could be. In fact, you could actually make this happen, this glorious fantasy land. By abandoning their lives, they became important symbols, supporting not only ISIS's message that Muslim women are unfairly targeted, singled out, and treated unequally because of their faith, but also taking a stand against a society that saw them as oppressed victims. Because now, you see, they were making their own choice, so they were not oppressed. Thus, the recruiters calling for women to leave their homeland to join the struggle were symbolically elevating their status and reclaiming their autonomy as rational agents. And sadly, now that ISIS is defeated, at least, their territory is defeated, these women have come to realize that they were reduced to nothing more than just commodities that existed for the sake of these men. And that the functions that were assigned to them were really attributed solely for the survival of the state, which is to breed more children and to grow their numbers. And I had heard news stories about women, especially in America, and I got really alarmed because I'd heard stories about women going from other parts of the world, but when I began to hear stories of some women joining ISIS from America, I wondered, why are they joining? This is the land of the free. This is the land of opportunity. Why do you have to leave this homeland? And I wanted to meet some of these girls. And I wanted to have an eyeball-to-eyeball conversation with them. And on May 24th, 2017, I was actually invited to meet one such girl. And I was expecting a frail, confused, vulnerable girl, perhaps maybe even a religious fanatic. And instead, when I met her, she was like anyone in this room. She exuded warmth and confidence. She was nothing like I had imagined. And I told her I wanted to help her, and I needed to understand why she was planning to join ISIS. In fact, she was not planning to join ISIS. She was the top recruiter for ISIS. The top recruiter for ISIS in the globe. And she was right in our own backyard. And we didn't even know it. So then I told her, tell me everything about yourself, where and when you were born, what was your family like, tell me all the good and the bad and the ugly that happened to you in your life, and then tell me how you wound up here. Because it's a way of rehabilitating a person. You really need to hear the story to understand where they were coming from. And then she told me about the harshness of her life, how she had lived in 20 foster homes, how she was abused as a child, how her mother had been taken away from her. And I realized that she had been failed by everybody in the society, from her family, from society, from community. But still, the question that was swirling in my head, this is the girl that had a head straight on, she was not crazy, was why join ISIS? And when I asked her if she could tell me how you got tangled into this thing. And she said, well, a friend of mine came over to me and we were just laughing and he shared this post with me about ISIS. And, you know, I'm really good on social media. And because she's very witty, very funny, street smart. And she said, you know, he had this post. And I said, oh, I can do that. He said, oh, you can? So she made her own post. She just changed it a little bit, made it a little funnier, and added an additional exclamation mark, and she posted it. And all of a sudden, she had all these followers. And then she said, oh, that's funny. I have all these followers. Look at that. And then she posted another one, and then she had more followers, and she was getting comments of people saying, what an amazing person you are. You're, you know, mashallah, you know, God be with you. Glory to God, you're so great. And all of a sudden, she's feeling this sense of greatness about her. And before she knew it, she was doing this and doing this, and she gave herself an alias name, and she was operating under the alias name. And furthermore, then she said, yeah, you know, then, you know, YouTube, you know, you can see a lot of videos on YouTube. You know, when you go on YouTube, you know, you see one video, and then after you're done with that, there's this algorithm that YouTube has. They'll recommend another video to you. And then she said, you have seen some of these videos are really funny. They're kind of, because, you know, this is a millennial generation that thinks everything on these YouTube channels, many of them, they just consume it as if it's some Hollywood thing. It's just, it's not even, it's like detached from reality. And so, and then, of course, she said that's how she had gotten involved in this. And then I still wanted to know, well, why were you planning to go there if you were planning to go there? And then she just looked at me and she said, well, I really just want a family. I don't have a family. I really want to have a family. I want to have a husband. I want to have children. I want to be safe. And they were going to provide me all that. And they were going to give me a job because, you know, I'm a top person. You know, I could be valuable. So for her, it was not political. For her, it was personal. And as I was concluding my talk, I showed her this Wise Up book, which we came up with, which is an entire volume on this subject. And I asked her, how could we rehabilitate other people using this material? And she gave me chock full of information on what we need to do for future. And, you know, then I asked her if she had any questions for me. And she looked at me and she said, well, why should I believe you and not them? To me, that was like a stunning question. And I thought, oh, this is what we're up against. You don't even know false from truth. You don't even know who's good and bad. So this is what I'm up against. And I really did not know how to answer this question. So the only thing that came to my mind was what our prophet said many years ago, which is, you know, through my tongue and my hand, you know, you will never be harmed. I said, can you say that about ISIS? And she said, no. She said, no, I can't say that about ISIS. I said, okay, so that's where we're at. You will not be harmed by me. I'm here to help you. So in a couple of weeks, I'll be going, being an expert witness for this young lady, to see if we can speak to the judge, because she is ready to be rehabilitated. She's ready to come back to society. She has lost 2 years. She's lost her mother while she was in detention. And the irony is that she hasn't really committed a crime in the U.S., according to U.S. law, because all she did was spread propaganda online, which is freedom of expression. It's protected. But yet, because she's connected with ISIS, she could be incarcerated for 20 to 30 years just on that basis. And so an entire life, and she knows that her life is ruined and wants to make amends and you know, wants to help other girls, prevent other girls from doing this. And I'm only sharing this with you because this is just one person that I have interacted with. Right now, we are seeing white supremacy and alt-right and these movements also pretty much taking the playbook from ISIS. And women joining these movements for the same reasons that these women were joining them, to birth a new nation, to, you know, to increase the numbers of the white race. And they are going to use the same tactics that ISIS was using to recruit these women online. And I am appealing to everybody here, whatever we can do in our capacity, to bring this to the attention of the social media companies, because we really need to have different policies that prevent young people from getting lured and sucked into these movements, because millennials are online all the time and we have an obligation to stop this from happening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
you for that very powerful anecdote. And I had a couple questions spring to mind. One, all of you have been talking about social media platforms sort of generically, and I'm wondering that in terms of the different mediums, if there are some platforms that are inherently more feminist in that they're more equitable and inclusive, and are there some that are more dangerous and exploitable? So are there variables between the different social media platforms?
I mean, I think one thing that's worth pointing out is that there are multiple platforms and they're kind of owned by two companies. Yes, you have Facebook and you also have Instagram and they're both owned by Facebook. You have Twitter, but it's like in social media, obviously there are international, like there's China-based ones and there's international ones that are more or less popular, but when you look at like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you're talking about two different companies. That's not three companies. I don't know that I would say that either of them are more feminist or more equitable. I think they all have their problems, and they're all run by white men, so that's already a problem. Facebook and Twitter have the same problem. They're both not great in terms of harassment. I think with Twitter, it's much more that people are allowed to harass, but both of them have problems with marginalized people and especially women getting their accounts suspended for relatively minor things. Like if you say, like, I hate white men, you can get banned. Meanwhile, men can say like horrifically rapey, death threaty type things to you and be fine. Not harassment. I don't think that there is any place that is fully safe to be online and especially to be a woman online. And I say that as someone who doesn't even get that much harassment. And I say that to those people who don't really get harassment at all. It's difficult because, we are now talking about the negatives, but I love social media. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's incredibly powerful. I think it has, I don't like the word empowerment, but in a very real sense, I think it has empowered a lot of voices that would otherwise not be heard. But I don't think that in the current iteration, we can say that any of them are feminist or safe, and they won't be until we're able to force or pressure Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg and all of them into actually understanding what women and other marginalized people need to be safe. And aligning with those interests versus the interests of profit.
I have a little slightly different perspective on this because primarily because I've spent a lot of the last year looking at information warfare online. And I would say I think that there is a fundamental difference between Twitter and Facebook. For different reasons. If you think about what is more feminist, I actually think that Twitter is more feminist and more equitable as far as how they allow people to get messages out there and how they allow you to connect with other people. But when it comes to, Facebook has this is actually, and Daisy, I'm really glad that you brought up what you did, because one of the things that we've seen as we've been tracking these online misinformation efforts is that they're not just trying to get right-wing women. They're trying to get left-wing women, too, actually. Mm-hmm. And they're targeting both sides of the political spectrum. And in addition to that, they're trying to, make women angry at each other, right? Like, they often use female profiles, fake female profiles, on both sides of the aisle to spew political messaging. And if you look online, and I have spent many, many hours researching this and looking at fake profiles, right, you'll see very often there are these profiles that are like grandmother profiles, right? And they do this on purpose because it's an unassuming kind of profile, right? Like people are more willing to trust grandmother-type, motherly-type figures who claim to be patriots or claim to be whatever, and they'll weaponize this, they'll weaponize women's issues all the time, constantly weaponizing women's issues. They're constantly trying to pit one side against the other. They will also weaponize you know, just in terms of intersectionality, they also weaponized tons of issues like the Black Lives Matter movement. They've constantly weaponized those that kind of hashtag activism on Twitter. And so in that way, Twitter is actually a less safe place to be, I think, because there, it is so easy to track these hashtags and to pile on to people who have said something or intimidate people who have said something that doesn't actually work with what you're thinking, right? Like, it's really easy to kind of... so here's an example, right? We, my co-founder published with Politico an article. This, he's a man, not a woman, but it's an example of what this looks like. So my co-founder published with Politico an article about online information warfare recently, and the journalist was a woman, so I guess that part counts. Mm-hmm. But because they had done a bunch of research to figure out whether the 2020 campaign was already being affected, and it turned out that it was. And they talked about the kinds of accounts that were behind these attacks and the kinds of which candidates were being most heavily targeted in the Democratic side of the race, because that was where most of what they were seeing was. As a result of that, they started getting thousands and thousands of emails and Twitter messages a day for a couple weeks, right? So that's what it feels like to... I was afraid at that moment that I might get doxxed, right? Because I'm connected with them, and which means basically like they call or swatted. They essentially, there are all kinds of variations of this, but if someone can find your public address, they can send 10,000 pizzas to your home, or they can call a SWAT team and tell them there's something terrible happening in your home and pretend to be a shooter, and they'll send a SWAT team out and break down your door in the middle of the night. So that's an example of what this kind of thing looks like online, and I think Twitter is actually a much more dangerous place for that, despite being a much more equitable platform for speech.
Thank you. And I also want to touch on another thing that you opened talking about in your opening remarks, this idea that for ages, this idea of the personal as political has been sort of a feminist anthem, and that social media platforms are based on sharing. And before social media, women did this at quilting bees, at knitting circles, at potlucks. When they weren't welcomed in the public sphere, they found ways to connect, to share stories, and that was really important about organizing and movements. So how can we make sure there's a balance between the sharing and connection that should be the motivation of social media and the kind of more masculine status, dominance, number of followers, doxing, that kind of discourse that is the negative of social media?
I don't know that number of followers is inherently masculine or negative. I mean, I think that's about being able to get your message out there.
As Daisy can attest.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is, again, putting pressure on the people who run these companies to have more... to have better terms of service and to actively enforce them. I mean, Twitter has been getting better. I don't actually see a lot of the harassment that I get, either because I'm able to pretty easily mute it or because they have a thing now where sometimes they just don't show you stuff, and I'll, like, you can click to see it, and sometimes I'll go, and it'll just be people being super anti-Semitic, or if I've said something about white privilege, they'll be like, you know you're white, right? And yeah, I mean, I think like they're slowly sort of trying to get it, but I think actively pressuring them to do better. I mean, it has in some ways been getting better. I have a number of friends who were targeted by Gamergate. I have friends who have stalkers to this day because they were targeted by Gamergate. A few years ago, I got a really creepy text telling me that I had been doxxed. And when I reached out to one of my friends who is an expert on this because she was targeted by Gamergate, she told me all of this stuff. And she's like, well, you know, here's the thing. If your stuff is on Reddit or 4chan, you can get it taken down. If it's on 8chan, you're kind of out of luck. But she's like, but also people have kind of diverted attention. It was always a crapshoot, but it's kind of the enthusiasm for it has died down. But there was a sense of recourse that there hadn't been for her. It's not as good as it should be, but I think there is slowly movement being made, and I think if we continue to put pressure and if we continue to really, really make it known that this is important, we will hopefully start to see more.
So I'm seeing this, I'm hopeful a little bit because I'm seeing that the pressure that is being applied to large corporations, you know, like Facebook, Twitter, Google, and they're being called to hearings where they're talking about the policy changes that they're making. I think you are going to see more of those policy changes. For instance, I was just at a hearing on hate crimes, increase in hate crimes and white supremacy in Washington, D.C. just a few days ago. And while Candace Owen was speaking, as she was speaking, all these people, her followers were coming on and there was all this hate stuff being hurled at the people, the members of Congress and other people who were testifying. And all of a sudden, while this was going on, the guy from Facebook was one testifying. They actually had to shut down the chat because it was hateful. So this is real. They just have to hire more people to monitor this stuff. And I think that these corporations are going to have to step up and do something because they're also beginning to soul search. What I'm worried about is not that. All the extremists and all the haters and all the bigots, they know how to find new outlets. So, you know, you can go to Telegram, you can go to forums. They actually penetrate autism forums because they know people are vulnerable there. And they will go to other forums, like you mentioned, you know, where they will pretend to be somebody, speak to you, have a conversation, because a lot of people are lonely. And that's why ISIS succeeded, is because they were approaching people who were very lonely and feeling isolated. And they were having random conversation about movies and tell me about your issues, what's going on. So then they befriend you. And then before you know it, you get roped in, and then they started feeding you their stuff, and you now have, you belong to something. You know, you belong to a group. It's the internet that we have to look at, because that is the information highway by which all of this information is available. So just because you make changes on Facebook, there's going to be another app, another something, somebody's going to come up, and that is what we have to worry about. And these people are extremely creative in finding all these. They use PlayStations, you know, PlayStation to speak to young kids. So that's why, you know, in our book, we actually laid out all the social media platforms so parents know what these things are. Do you know, why does your child have Kick on their website? I mean, as an app. Who are they speaking to? Like, would you allow a predator to come to your home? It's the same thing. Having access on your phone is no different. You're just allowing your kid to communicate with somebody who's dangerous. Don't we tell children, hey, don't speak to strangers? So this is, we have to apply the same rules to online engagement, and we have to be very careful as parents and as, you know, families to prevent and put rules with our own children and with the younger generation, because they get manipulated into it. So it's the internet. And I know people don't like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg too much, but he just wrote an article about this, that there needs to be new policy changes in on the internet itself. It was in the New York Times a few weeks ago.
Can I say something positive? As we were just talking about harassment, like one point I just wanted to actually make on a more positive end about the type of people who are able to get their message out and get visibility through social media. Disabled people are one group where if you fundamentally, and chronically ill people, if you fundamentally cannot leave your house to go to an event, if you cannot, because of your physical health, because of whatever, if you're often stuck at home, social media can be a way to engage, to raise awareness about the issues that you are dealing with, can be a way to really allow people a better understanding of what it is that you're dealing with and combat ableist messaging. I also think that social media has been huge for helping sex workers normalize their identities, combat stigma, because sex workers are obviously in a position where there's extreme stigma. For some of them, it's not safe to publicly identify themselves. And social media, while it doesn't always work and you can get doxxed,
theoretically allows you to, not necessarily anonymously, but in a somewhat more guarded way, where you're protecting your identity, speak about your experiences, and speak about your experiences in a way where you are moderating what is publicized about your identity and what is being communicated. And for people who are in stigmatized and potentially illegal work, that's huge. And that, I mean, I've seen just a massive shift in how the media treats sex workers and relates to sex workers, because social media has enabled sex workers to cut out the middleman, communicate their message directly, and combat stigma and stereotypes about who they are and what kind of people do their work. So that's a positive, at least.
You know, absolutely. And I want to curate some of the questions that have been coming in. Some people have been asking what the social media companies should do, and you've addressed some of those things. And then I have a question, a student who is actually going into the social media field after graduation. She asks what she can do to advocate for women. So that's one question that ties into another one. What's your opinion on women's responsibility to have to educate men on these issues?
Oh, I've got a really good answer for who is the, if you don't mind, who's going in social media? So this is awesome, because I've been talking all week about how important it is for employees at tech companies to have an impact in their companies. It's actually the best way that you can have an impact on company policy, mm-hmm. is by organizing internally. We've seen over and over and over again. I was just talking about this in my keynote just before this, but we've seen Google change their policies, we've seen Facebook change their policies, we've seen Twitter change their policies, all because of the pressure of employees. That's by far the best way to get tech companies to change their policies. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to answer the other one.
Yeah, about what we need them to do? I mean, we need better anti-harassment policies. Certainly, we need them to suspend more accounts. We need them to suspend fewer accounts of marginalized people. We need, I think, more crackdowns on bots that are just harassing people every day. And I know there is, like, slow stuff towards this, but I think ideally we'd get new leadership, and we would get leadership that is from groups that are more likely to be targeted. Because when you have white men and straight white men and wealthy straight white men specifically making the decisions about what counts as harassment and what counts as acceptable use of their platform, you often see that a lot of really vulnerable people are not protected.
And that gets at another question about how generationally the platforms are used differently. So, for instance, sexual harassment and the conversation about Joe Biden right now, who's 78 years old, right? And the norms were different back then. So do you see that generationally that there is improvement and that we're moving away from cultural norms that were just taken for granted?
No, you're okay. Younger generation. You should answer that.
Well, you've seen more generations than I have.
Oh, do I look that old?
Maybe we could both answer
it. I'm only kidding.
I think we are seeing a shift. I think younger women are definitely much less willing to put up with things these days, and they feel much more comfortable speaking up about harassment and issues of abuse and trauma. So, yeah, I think that is definitely a shift, and it's partially just a generational. It's like a generational experience. You are more comfortable with, you know, when you come into the world, you see things with new eyes, and you see things that are seem unjust, that are happening to you in your life, and you ask why? Why are these things happening? And you haven't necessarily had the same kind of. There are fewer people who will say, oh, well, that's just the way things are, right? And so younger women, I think, are definitely much less willing to accept that, because that's the way culturally we've been attuned. We grew up in a time when, you know, this was not as acceptable as it has been in past generations. But I think what's really interesting, and one of the things I think is actually a part of the conversation that I don't often talk about because it's controversial, is that I actually think that the women's movement in general is kind of doing itself a little bit of a disservice right now by being so anti-men. right? And this is something that I think I've heard more often from women who are a little bit older, is this perspective that, like, there are a lot of good guys out in the world, and us getting angry at them is an important part of the process, but it's not necessarily going to change their perspective, right? You don't actually change someone's mind by telling them what an asshole they are. That, like, immediately puts up a wall. Mm-hmm. And so I would actually love to see, I think one of the weaknesses of the women's movement is that it's created a barrier in a lot of ways rather than an opening for better and deeper conversation. And that's not universally true, but I think that's been one of the things that I've been a little bit sad to see as an outcome of that.
Yeah. So, yeah. May I comment?
Yeah.
Are we going to the next question?
Or? Go ahead.
Okay. So a couple of things. So I just wanted to answer the first question because I did have a specific recommendation. So I think there should be zero tolerance for dangerous speech on all the platforms. It should be taken down immediately, zero tolerance for it. Not free speech, you know, like dangerous speech is people that incites people to violence. That should be unacceptable and taken off immediately, and they should have staff. There are tons of people all over the world that know how to use social media. You can pay them pittance just like they get all these outsourced people from all over the world. They can have people just sitting there all day long watching and taking the stuff down. So that's one thing they can do. Secondly, they should never allow any of their platforms to be used for terrorist propaganda. They allowed YouTube to be used for terrorist propaganda, Twitter, and that's why ISIS grew by leaps and bounds. I mean, we used to beg them to take down al-Awlaki's videos because he had a manifesto on how to make a bomb in your kitchen, you know, in your mother's kitchen. And a lot of people who are in jail will tell you that they went to al-Awlaki's video because they got inspired by him because he was a very charismatic speaker. Similarly, the stuff that you have in Norway, Breivik, his manifesto is being used by all these white supremacy people, and it's populating because these are loose networks of people that get inspired by one another. And so why are we allowing these platforms to be used to further somebody's propaganda? It's just a very simple question. Would you allow it on television? Would you allow it? You know, why would you allow it? So that's a question because, you know, people say it's a slippery slope, freedom of expression. No, it's freedom of expression. I understand that, free speech, I understand. But these are people who are manipulating these platforms for their political aims, and which are then affecting a lot of innocent people. Innocent lives are getting confessed. The second question about generationals. I spend a lot of time with millennials. I'm surrounded by them. I adore them. I love them. But the way we navigate each other is we actually have conversations with one another. They have made me so much better as a human being because they have so much to offer us, the older generation, but they don't have the wisdom and the years behind their ears. And so when I speak to them, I pass on my wisdom to them, years and years of know-how, the things that I have learned, the mistakes that I have made. And that way we come somewhere in the middle. And we're having these conversations one-on-one. I don't know how they have these conversations on social media because it's so abrupt, it's so short, you can't have this dialogue because you really have to speak to people in their eyes and they have to see you, your expression, and you can't do that on social media. But I agree that we should not bash all men because I'm supported by all the men in my family. And so what does it feel like if you're a man? You know, it's not fair. We should just go for the people that are perpetrators, you know, specifically single them out and not lump everybody together because no one wants to be lumped together. Women don't like to be lumped together, right? Because, you know, we get lumped together as this and that. So that, I think, we should also be careful about that. And then I think there was a third question.
So I guess if we're talking about hating men, I bristle at this because I think that this idea of like feminists hate men, feminists are all angry at men, is this like long-standing stereotype that really is just a flattening and oversimplification of what's actually going on. What I tend to see, going back to social media, what I tend to see oftentimes is that there will be women who are making jokes and there's a context collapse and men come in and are like, you hate all men.
And, you know, of course, we all speak in generalizations, and there's often this point that's made that's oftentimes when people say, ban men. It's not men, it's the patriarchy. It's the same thing that, you know, I often see tweets from my black friends and friends of color that are talking about white people. And they're talking about white supremacy, or they're talking about a specific type of white person, and it's not about me. And so, I don't know, I just find it a little bit frustrating when people who are in a position of power are overly sensitive and are kind of holding people's fundamental safety and rights hostage unless they are spoken to in the way that they deem appropriate. I find that just a reinforcement of privilege. But yeah, of course I like men. Some of my best friends are straight white men, whatever. But I do want to actually touch on one point. We haven't actually talked about this, but I think it's a belief a lot of people have about social media, and I just want to combat the idea that social media and the internet are somehow a separate thing from real life, or that, you know, it's different and it's more dangerous. I mean, I think, you know, you see sometimes this, like, this person killed themselves because they were bullied on social media, and that's not what happened. What happened was that this person was dealing with some kind of mental health issue and experienced a negative event on social media that potentially put them in a mind frame where they chose to die by suicide. And that is tragic, but that's not a thing. It's not that if social media weren't there, this person would not have those health problems, mental health problems.
I actually totally disagree with that, because I think what you're missing is that, like, a lot of times when those stories come up, they're about really young people.
Can I finish my point,
yeah,
though? I'm saying that there are pre-existing mental health issues that that intensify and put one at risk of dying by suicide. There are a lot of, like, really difficult things that happen online and off that don't result in people dying by suicide. Suicide tends to be the result of having mental health issues, dealing with a lot of other things. It's not just about dealing with a lot of stress. But my larger point that I wanted to make is that what I think the internet can pervert and intensify stuff. I mean, I certainly deal with a lot more anti-Semitism online than I do in my offline life. But it's because it's providing a conduit, not because it is manufacturing a thing. And I think that when people are experiencing it negatively, it is often a combination of what we are dealing with in our real lives, or not real lives, what we are dealing in our offline lives, versus what we experience online. I mean, to go back to Daisy's original point, you know, the women who are recruited by ISIS online, the internet is providing a conduit to ISIS, absolutely. But as you mentioned, they are also women who feel isolated by Islamophobia, who are dealing, who are vulnerable, who have all of these things that the internet didn't create. And I don't know, I see it a lot when people talk about porn, this idea of, like, you see internet porn and then you're turned into a monster. And it's like, no, you come to internet porn with no understanding of sexuality because you didn't get a good sex education, and then this is the information that you get, and that shapes you. But that's not because of the internet. That's because of the internet filling in a vacuum that is left by the rest of your life. So, just and I'm happy to hear a counterpoint on that. But I do think it's a pairing.
Sorry for interrupting you. That was very masculine of me. I guess the thing that I totally agree with what you're saying. Any time that you're dealing with something online, it is often a figment of what is happening in your life offline, right? If you're being bullied online, you're probably also being bullied offline. But I think the thing that I think is really important not to conflate is the fact, and not to avoid, is the fact that social media is the perfect magnifying glass for that kind, yes, of abuse. And if you're having some, you know, all of these people online sending you messages, I've been getting those for years because, just as a journalist, you do, right? You have tons of people telling you how stupid you are and how you're such an idiot and you're so controlling and you're, you know, like, I've gotten all of those things, right? But if you're, you know, if I had started getting those when I was 12 years old online, I don't know that I would have been good at dealing with that. I don't think I would have been. I think it would have been really traumatizing. And that has nothing to do with mental health, right? That's just because you're at a really delicate, like, formative stage in who you are and trying to figure out what's going on and what the world is like and who you are as a person. And that, I think it's really important that we, like, distinguish between those two things, because...
I mean, I still do disagree with this idea that it has nothing to do with mental health, because I think how we cope with trauma, and if we are isolated, and all of this is about the support systems that we have, like, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that I do think that online attacks, I have friends who have been online harassment, I have friends who have been, like, quote-unquote canceled online, for whom it is a deep and intense trauma. But I think that it is not like, this is what I'm really combating against. It's like, I don't think if I am a well-adjusted person with a really healthy support system who has a resilience against dealing with trauma, that I get online bullied and suddenly I kill myself, which is, I think, like the narrative that we hear a lot. And I think that this idea that, yes, absolutely, I agree with you that the internet intensifies this stuff, it exposes you to a lot of stuff, it can absolutely have negative impacts on your mental health. But I think that the people for whom it has the most negative impact are people who are already socially isolated, people who are already vulnerable, people who are dealing with other things. But I mean, it may be semantics or it may be a point of actual disagreement, which is fine.
So I just want to add to that, because I think that it's usually not just mental health, because when we studied ISIS and human vulnerabilities, there are really five areas of vulnerabilities, what make people vulnerable. So it can be anything to do with relational, like family, disaffliction, like, you know, maybe you just don't have a healthy family and the families are torn apart and you feel like you don't belong, you're just all by yourself, and you don't have that security that you get from a family. It can be personal, like you have adolescent issues, you know, you're being bullied, you're being difficulty in adolescence. It can be external. An external factor was a very big factor for Muslims who were joining ISIS, was because it was the societal debate that was going on, where you felt you were being attacked by society itself. You know, where I'm sure there's some white people right now, some white men probably feel attacked because there's all this conversation about white supremacy, and so people are like, why are they talking about me? I'm a white person. And so societal debates or negative societal debates about that group add significantly, because those are usually people in positions of power. You know, like when the president of the United States says, Islam hates us, well, what are we Muslims supposed to think? You know, and that becomes a recruiting tool for the recruiters. And then it can be psychological. You can have mental health issues, and it can be social identity. Like, how do you identify yourself? Is your identity weak? Do you belong? You know, do you have friends, or do you feel completely alienated? So all of these combinations can make a person vulnerable. Now, oftentimes in the past, when we did not have the internet, people would join gangs, or they would, you know, go into drug addiction, or they would join something where they felt comfort somewhere, something. So the internet is just providing that passage. It's a very fast, straight line, because you can find a lot of support groups in any one of these areas, including people who then lure you and use your vulnerability to join them. And that's why this stuff is so dangerous, is because it's as complex as human beings are.
So I'm going to try to tie a couple of these questions together. There was an earlier question about gatekeeping and whether social media is more or less likely to gatekeep who can speak and whether or not their issue is valid for a particular movement. And it connects to something that someone asked too about. She says, I recently read about dirty deleting. The idea that we shame people who edit or erase social media posts. And when we shame social media behavior that isn't hate speech, how does shaming perhaps hit women differently than men? And does that have to do with gatekeeping and editing, what people say?
So a couple of things. I mean, I don't know about deleting. I mean, I have seen deleting shame around, like, Kevin Hart. around, like, whatever, around people who are trying to just, like, hide stuff. But at the same time, I also know so many people in media who have now set their tweets to just auto-delete after a few months. And I know a lot of people who are just deleting their archives. And that just seems to be a standard practice. I mean, I don't delete stuff because my reputation is already in the toilet. As someone who's been writing about sex and the adult industry for a long time, I'm like, people still want to deal with me. I'm not really that worried about my reputation. But I don't know. I think the shaming isn't exactly about deleting or editing. It's about if people are trying to hide their bad behavior and escape accountability. I think that's where the shaming comes in. I mean, I think that, you know, the internet, I don't think that shame and the way it happens on the internet is necessarily the most productive way of handling things, but I think that, you know, it's not necessarily about deleting, it's about when people are deleting stuff as a way of avoiding accountability. Like, a recent example of this was the journalist Lauren Duca, who has positioned herself as feminist and inclusive and all of this, and then people found old tweets from a few years ago where she'd said really nasty things about fat people. And the people were like, how are you presenting yourself as, like, body positive and body inclusive when you've said all this really, really nasty stuff? And she, I think, didn't really answer it and just kind of deleted the tweets and has, as far as I know, not really engaged with this, not apologized, not really said, you know, I used to say really horrible things and I feel terrible about them and I have changed. I don't think she really took accountability, and that's where the problem is for me, when you're trying to just erase stuff rather than saying, yeah, I used to have bad opinions and then I learned and I got better. In terms of gatekeeping, which to me that feels like a separate question, but I do want to touch on it, I think the internet has significantly less gatekeeping than the real world, for good and for bad. On the good side, you know, you see voices of color, you see trans voices, you see women's voices getting a lot more amplification than they do when you have a TV station where you have old white men deciding who gets to be on the TV station. For bad, there's a lot of things that maybe polite discourse would keep quiet. There's a lot more racism. There's a lot more transphobia. There's a lot more just violent speech that people feel more liberated to share online. And that, I think, is terrible. Things that people might not feel comfortable saying to your face, they feel very comfortable saying online. And actually, there's a podcast that I have been on that I really love called Conversations with People Who Hate Me, hosted by Dylan Marin, where he takes two people, like one person who has left basically a negative comment or sent a cruel email, and the recipient of that, and he talks to both of them and has them have a phone conversation, and sometimes it's not resolved, and sometimes the person is like, you know, I was just in a bad mood and I feel terrible, or sometimes the person is like, now that I'm talking to you, I see that I was wrong and I was just firing something off because I wasn't thinking about it. And I think, I think that the way that the internet enables us to just kind of fire stuff off has a destructive impact for sure.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I want to open up another question, and again, tie these together. But a questioner wonders about the disparity about the way that we've been talking about men and women. So women are allowed to make jokes, and yet women in this moment, or that, Barrett, you had mentioned that women can't talk about things, or they feel like they can't talk about insecurities or miscarriages, and yet men have always been told to not express emotions and be strong. So how do those gender disparities play out on social media?
Yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, like, both sides of the gender, I would say the whole spectrum of gender suffers from gender stereotypes. Men absolutely suffer from feeling like they need to not, you know, be emotional. I try very hard with all the men in my life to get them to talk to me about their emotions. I think it's really important. And it goes both ways, absolutely. Men don't have miscarriages, so I'm not surprised that they don't talk about them online.
Trans men can.
Sorry. Most men.
Yeah.
Not all men can have miscarriages.
Hashtag.
But yeah, I think we all suffer from these kind of snap judgments that we make of each other online, right? As Alex was just saying, like, you don't know people that you feel like you know people that you meet online, but you actually don't. You don't know, you know, as Daisy was saying, you don't know what their background is. You don't know why, what their day was like. You don't know who, like, said something really mean to them, or, you know, whose pet died, or whose family is falling apart, like whose mom has cancer, or whose daughter has, you know, like, there are so many things that go into a person's persona that you never see online. And I think it's really important for us to just to remember that, you know, as we're talking to each other and interacting with each other online. One of the things I think is really interesting we found, I've talked about this as it relates to disinformation and political warfare, but there's been this trend. So historically, when you got to know someone, you would get to know them in a bunch of different ways, right? Like, you would get to know their political beliefs and maybe their cultural beliefs, but you would also get to know them because you'd just be hanging out with them at your kid's softball game. And the thing that the internet erases are those loose social ties, right? And those are the things that actually give us empathy for other people. So you feel empathy for someone because you know that they had a hard day at school, right? Or you know that they're really suffering in their job right now. But you only know that if you actually know them in the real world. And so as we move, that is something that we've seen have a big impact on political polarity and this feeling of just everyone antagonizing each other across the country. And as it's something that is increasing, actually, fundamentally, because from a migration perspective, we're seeing movement of, you know, more liberal, more better educated people into cities and away from rural communities. And therefore, there's actually less, a lot less, significantly less kind of loose social connection with people who think differently than you on both sides. And so I think it's really interesting to think about those factors and to remember those things as you're having these conversations online. Because the person on the other side of the computer or the internet or whatever, however you want to call it, is a real human person. And it's worth putting some extra time and energy into thinking about that.
So on the topic of who gets to say what, I guess this is probably going to be the last thing I say. I just want to tell a brief story about my friend Sarah Jung, who you may know. She was a contributor to Vice, and then she was at The Verge for a while, and she's also someone who was targeted by Gamergate, which is significant for this story. But what really significantly happened is that I believe last summer, it was about a year or two ago, she got hired by the New York Times opinion section as a tech writer on the editorial board. And as you may have guessed from her name, she's Korean. And somebody dug up some old tweets that she had where she was just making these jokes about white people. Because she was, you know, it would often be just a way to, like, blow off steam because she dealt with a lot of racist harassment, both offline and on. And I don't remember the specifics of her tweets, but people started highlighting them, and they were like, the New York Times is hiring a racist. What kind of racist? Blah, blah, blah. Sarah, you hate white people. You're a racist. And the Times released some statement about it. She released a sort of, like, apology, like, oh, you know, just my way of dealing with this stress of being harassed through this kind of humor, blah, 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 and, like, whatever. And then people continued to harass her even after she apologized. And she did this experiment for several months where all of her tweets were just the most mundane things. She would tweet out a link with no context, or tweet out just like a dumb picture, and it would be like completely anodyne. And if you would go to those tweets, you would see they would all have hundreds of responses, and the hundreds of responses were just like, Sarah, you're a racist. Why do you hate white people? Blah, blah, blah. Sarah is disgusting. And I mean, it was a really interesting experiment because, you know, she had apologized, she was not posting anything provocative, and she was still getting harassed on every single tweet because it wasn't about her hating white people. It was about this group of people wanting to silence a woman of color and wanting to silence her voice. And I think that, you know, it's really important when we look at how people are communicating online as to whether or not their criticisms are actually in good faith or if they're just intended to silence and shut people down.
So I'd just like to bring a completely different perspective, not necessarily related to social media, but of course this is aided by social media. I see two massive trends happening in the world right now. And when I say massive, I'm talking global trends. The rise of extremism everywhere in the world, largely spread through social media because it allows you to connect people. I mean, look at Myanmar, you know, rumors spreading, a genocide happening there. Look at India, a rumor spreads and there's lynchings of people and, you know, nationalism, xenophobia, intolerance spreading in Europe. You just saw New Zealand happen, and this is on the rise and it's not even crested yet. But at the same time, here's the hopeful news. At the same time, women are running and stepping up in leadership positions at a scale that we have not seen. And I fundamentally believe that this confluence of these two is not surprising at all. Because you have hate, evil, negativity, intolerance, everything that, you know, is like pointing to war and destruction. And then you have the nurturers stepping up, the mothers, the saviors, the women with empathy stepping up. Yes, they're going to be great leaders. And you saw an example of this in New Zealand, right? Is she not lauded as like a leader? So we need women who are going to, if Amy is going to come here, she needs to look at what Jacinda did in New Zealand. And we need to see women acting like women, the reservoir of the qualities that they have. They don't have to be like men. They just have to be them. Because there's so much we have to offer the world right now, and there's so much the world needs from us. You know, we have this quality of being collaborators. It's one of the unique skills that we have. We're very resourceful. So what did Jacinda do? Everybody thinks, oh, she was just empathetic. She said this. No, she got everybody together and passed laws against guns in her own country. She knew how to find the right resources in her country. She convinced her population this was the right thing to do. Yes, it's a small nation, and you can't compare it to the United States and all this other stuff. But why can't we model that? Why can't we use that model? So I think that, I don't think we're going to get destroyed as a race, because I think that women are going to step up and save the day.
Great. That's, thank you to our panelists, and that's a nice way to end.
Thank you so much.